It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Welcome to another edition of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. You fools have joined us for what we think will be a particularly good edition of the program. Today, we're pleased to welcome singer-songwriter Matthew Ryan for an interview. Matthew has a great new album out called I Recall Standing As Though Nothing Could Fall, and he's one of our favorite artists here at Pop Dose. We'll talk with Matthew about that new record, touring plans for the album, and quite a few other subjects. Make sure to check out Matthew on the web at MatthewRyanOnline.com. And without further ado, I'm going to turn things over to my good pal, Jeff Giles.
So let's talk about the new record.
All right.
One of the things that always interests me about your sound is the way you tend to kind of bob and weave between really sort of traditional, you know, four-piece rock and roll and then machine-assisted stuff. And this is toward the latter end of that spectrum. And I wanted to talk to you about why.
I think part of it's, I've just always had a curiosity about more experimental music, particularly, bands that were really cinematic yet kind of non-organic, and then because of the singers and the songs almost became more human. And so I've always had a real curiosity about that from either the early U2 records, particularly Unforgettable Fire or Joy Division or the Blue Nile, Then also grew up loving songs. Like, to me, songs are everything. If you don't have a song, all the cinema in the world is meaningless. For the same reason I can't watch movies that are based strictly on special effects,
right.
There has to be a story.
So who were some of the songwriters that were really kind of driving you towards developing your own craft?
It's funny. I can go from really traditional kind of songwriting to, of course, some of the more esoteric stuff like Waits. But I would say the first songwriter that really, really killed me, certainly not unique in this, were Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen.
Right on.
But then also, you can't deny a song like Always On My Mind and He Stopped Loving Her Today. I just always have loved songs, I'm probably more of a fan of songs than I am of artists sometimes.
What do you think were really kind of the important pieces that you kind of took from some of those early songs that were influencing you and started to... what did you start to employ from those?
That's a mysterious question. I think probably just connectivity, intimacy. Great songs are relevant to virtually anybody. That's a tough question.
When you're writing, do you punch in? Or do you just kind of take the inspiration as it comes?
Oh, I am not a craft writer. I can admire craft, but to me it's something I just wait for and I've come to be able to identify when I'm in that particular mood.
You record a lot.
I do.
it seems like that inspiration must come pretty regularly to you.
Those are two different muscles, I love, I spend a lot of time just creating sounds and, vibe, and those usually lead to songs,
Right.
I love, it's kind of like being a painter when you're messing around with a keyboard sound or a beat in conjunction with a guitar. I'll never forget, when I was writing Return to Me, I had found that loop and I started messing with the sound of it, and then it just, that guitar fit right in with it, and the next thing you know, you have a song, But before that, it's just weather. I love doing that,
Return to Me kills me.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're writing a song like that, are you writing towards a record, or did the songs themselves come together to make that record?
Man, I wish I had more control over it, The songs really dictate what happens. I just follow it, you know, and it, you know, everybody, I mean, even Tom Petty, I've read interviews with him where he talks about songwriting, and we can start sounding like, you know, weird wizards with our satchels of magic, you know, but the songs dictate it. I've always admired Springsteen because he seems very workman about what he does and is able to kind of, you know, almost, you know, carve it out of stone, you know. That's pretty badass. But I'm more accidental. The songs dictate. And then I just, as I go through the process, I try and understand what's going on and try and make a cohesive. It's odd because they always seem to come from a similar point of view or something, you know, that has clearly been on my mind. But again, I just follow the trail and trust that it'll be a collection, you know, it'll be a novel, so to speak, you know.
Was there a moment this time around when you knew you had a record?
I recall Standing As Though Nothing Could Fall was one of the toughest records I've made. Partially because my intentions going in were to kind of maybe have some control and write a particular type of record, but that's not what happened. The songs kept coming the way that they did, and in some ways I was resistant to it because I wanted to write more of a stripped down kind of acoustic record, a more content record.
You should know better than that by now.
Well, I know, but you know, if you know, you're done. You know, so I just kept following it, you know. But as far as knowing when it was done, I think I knew it was done when I'd gotten a song for a friend done. I felt like I'd said all I could say about this particular intersection, you know.
This new record finds you working again with a producer. What made you head back in that direction?
Greg didn't really give me a choice. We've become really close friends and we're kind of kindred spirits. So we'd been doing some stuff in a side project called A Dead Satellites. And he just, you know, I don't know. He's just such a great guy and he kind of excites me about what I'm doing. And that's always good, you know? It's a good thing to have somebody that's really excited about what you're doing.
I read an interview where you were talking about the new album and you said something about the songs kind of being addressed to the younger generation.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, I can remember years ago reading an article on some kids in the Sudan and their you know, their ability to still be joyful under virtually any circumstances, whether it's war or famine. You know, when you come into the world is what the world is. You don't know any different, you know. But I think there's kind of been an assault on people's imaginations through marketing and now through the constant information, you know, in the information age. And I guess, you know, you risk sounding like a grumpy old man, you know. These damn cars. Where's everybody going? You know? But I don't know. I think there's been a real assault on people's on young people's imaginations. There's a lot of engagement via, you know, video games and the internet. But all those engagements that have been created for them have borders. They all have borders. Not to mention, you know, 9/11 and the confrontation we're currently having with capitalism and what is capitalism and how do you define it? You know, does it have morality? Does it not? You know, environmental issues. I mean, I don't know. As a young person, and I can only imagine, you've got to be looking at some of these things kind of going, you know, the wolves are in the hen house or something, you know?
I think that's an interesting point that you bring up, Matthew, when you talk about us growing up as kids. It's like we know what we know at that point. And I think what I've discovered as I've gotten further down the road is what today's generation is also going to learn, that you really start to learn more about the stuff that you were involved with or aware of as a kid, and you start to learn more about what it all means.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel protective on some level of the younger generation. I think we stand at this strange intersection where we have great possibilities, but we also have limited resources, and we have I'm a firm believer that global warming is happening. It only stands to reason, and it's our responsibility as adults to be invested in the future. I mean, you look at public education right now. None of it makes any sense. It doesn't make sense socially. It doesn't make sense culturally. None of it makes sense. And so, I don't know. I guess, I can't imagine what it's like for younger people. And like I said, the world is what the world is. I mean, it's what they know. As older folks, we have a responsibility to ensure they have a future, and they have a responsibility to engage, you know, with politics, with these issues, you know. I don't know. It's like I said, it sounds curmudgeonly, but it's important shit. It is important stuff.
I don't think it sounds curmudgeonly, and one of the things that I always respond to in your music is the tension between accepting that shit is fucked up and refusing to give up hope.
Absolutely, man. I get so frustrated at times. Sometimes I joke about it. Maybe it's my voice. Maybe my voice just sounds like bad news, you know? But my stuff is depressing is bullshit. It's somebody that is not listening. And listen, music is absolutely subjective. I understand that. You're more than welcome not to like it. But to just dismiss it as depressing or bummer, you know? Well, you know, what you said, Jeff, and, you know, I risk being self-congratulatory, but I agree 100%. And yes, stuff is scary. Stuff is stretched thin, and our way of life, which is beautiful, I love America, but it can be better, and it should be better, because a lot of the things we're doing are at great risk to ourselves. And
yeah, I think I'm sorry.
And so on, you know. Go ahead.
Well, the interview that I referenced before, I think you probably remember the one that I'm talking about. It started because the writer, I think, said something on Facebook about the new album being sounding resigned.
Yeah.
And, to me, your sort of artistic persona has always reminded me of that scene in Cool Hand Luke, where Paul Newman is fighting who is it, George Kennedy?
Uh huh.
And he just refuses to go down, even though
there's no greater compliment, Jeff. I do me a favor, if you could status update that somewhere, I will retweet that in a heartbeat. That's badass.
I will say, though, that I do miss the Silver State.
I understand that. You know,
and I'm sure you probably hear that.
Yeah. Listen, man, I mean, all those things will be revisited.
Yeah.
But I can only do what my gut tells me to do. If I did anything else, it would be disgenuine, you know?
Right.
I can understand that. You know, people, I have a weird relationship with the artist I love, you know? You know, why can't Waits just make Bone Machine again? You know, or you know, and so on and so on, you know? But we have to understand as lovers of music that, you know, artists got to go through that process. And it hasn't gone away. It's just, you know, you got to go through that process. Neil Young being a great example, somebody who took tremendous risks. You got to allow for that, man. You know, it's not manufactured, you know?
Yeah, and it can't be. we're talking about the artistic process a little bit. Can we also talk about the business side, being that you are a label?
Yeah, sure.
How's that working out for you?
I'm kind of, you know, there's parts of it that I absolutely love. There's other parts of it that I don't like self-promotion, you know, and I'm kind of in a position where I have to do that. I would love to believe that my work itself spoke for itself and could create a life for itself, but, you know, we are, anybody that has a horse in a race knows that we are in a blizzard. It is very, very difficult, particularly with work that's sublime or subtle or not hyped, to get people to stop and pay attention for a second. I mean, I just watched a documentary the other night that art is under a tremendous stress in the current culture that we're living in because there's very little time in people's lives to sit back and reflect. And art requires that. Art requires that opportunity to engage you with a moment, with a real moment, not only with yourself, but with the art itself, you know? And I'm not good at self-promotion. I don't enjoy it. I also, you know, I just find that I have ever since I started this label, I have less and less time to be an artist, and that's going to have to change. Otherwise, you know, I have no interest in running a business.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting because that is one of the main hang-ups is how much of that stuff, which was formerly handled by multiple sets of hands, suddenly falls on you. And on the one side of things, I would think that being your own person and being your own label certainly leaves you free artistically to explore many different things, work with many different people, and have several different projects. But then there's also the other side of things that if you don't have time to be an artist, that kind of defeats the purpose of the whole thing. So what's the solution to work around that?
I don't know. I mean, I've worked on pretty much every level of the music industry, you know. Maybe some sort of utopia will surface here as far as how artists can be artists and engage with people. But most of all, my life and my intent is to be an artist, and it's what drives me. It's what I love. It's what makes me incapable of holding down respectable jobs like teaching and, you know, and fixing cars and being a fireman or, you know. But I don't know, Matt. I don't know. I mean, I know that one of the things I've learned is that we're operating culturally in a rushing river, you know, and information is constant. And basically the way that you reach people is that somebody happens to be standing at a particular point in that stream and it hits them in the chest and they check it out for a second. If you're lucky, they engage with it. But it seems more and more that we deal in instant judgment, which is, again, dangerous to art. It's dangerous to politics as well. It's dangerous to virtually every part of you know, our humanity. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's how I'm trying to make a living. So I'm just going to have to try and strike a balance. I do miss having parts, other parts of the... you know, what would you call it?
The machine.
Machine creeps me out because I didn't like the machine either, you know? but at any rate, I do think there's a sweet spot that hasn't been found because if I keep going this way, I'm probably going to stop making records. This isn't fun. I'm having to do too much. I'm too engaged. With the other side of my work, and I'm not enjoying it, to be honest with you.
Do you want to talk about Spotify at all? I've talked to a few artists lately where that's sort of the elephant in the room. In fact, I talked to one guy the other day who wouldn't talk about it on the record because he's so terrified.
I think that Spotify is a great idea, but again, it sees the scene, but it's missing the plot, you know?
Well, it also misses your bank account.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's 0.006 cents per stream.
Something like that, yeah.
You know, but that's better than what, you know, YouTube is playing.
Right.
Paying. You know, unless I want to put an ad on my song, which I refuse to do. I'm not going to do it. It's a funny thing. I mean, there's other people monetizing my songs online because they did it for some TV show that got a ton of views, and they have an ad on there. It's beautiful and it's crazy at the same time. But the fundamental issue is that I believe that people are going to have... Listen, we adjust to every new invention that changes the way we live. You know, we're still adjusting to the automobile. There's repercussions from the automobile.
Right.
And if we don't adjust to the internet, it's going to fundamentally change our humanity. Now, I don't know if that's ultimately bad or good, but it makes me nervous. Our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with each other... It's changing. You know, it seems like people would prefer an ATM to a face-to-face, you know, encounter with a bank teller. And, this has been a growing issue, and the internet, I think, is only making it more interesting, to say the least.
Right.
Listen, I mean, I don't mean to sound bummed out about it because my way of life is being challenged. It's not just strictly a... self-obsessed point of view here. I mean, I really, really think that the internet is a beautiful thing, but if we don't get control of it, you know, we're liable to, I don't know. I don't know what becomes of people that have no sense of intimacy with each other. I don't imagine it's a particularly good situation.
From your perspective, what would you like to see added to the equation that's missing right now?
Well, I would like to see a movement like there was a kill your television movement. I would like to see a kill your computer movement. I find it fascinating that it hasn't come yet. There's been no rebellion against, you know, the kind of over-the-top immersiveness, or I wouldn't even call it immersiveness. I would call it its absolute preoccupation. Everybody kind of gripes about it. You know, they have, you know, smartphone-free weekends and, you know, but they can't wait till Monday, you know? We're going to have to get this under control. I don't know, man. I think that we're just going to have to, you know, get it under control.
What do you think of the idea that we're...
When I say get it under control, I'm not talking about regulations and stuff like that. I'm talking about personal, like, responsibility to say... to allow for ourselves. I got this fear, man, that we're not going to have beautiful epic films anymore. I have this fear that, like, we'll never get another Cinema Paradiso because people can't watch something more than 6 minutes long. This, I'm telling you, man, if we let go of that part of our culture, of our humanity, the arts, something's changing. It's not good.
Right.
We need to have the ability for consideration and engagement like that in our lives.
You remind me of what happened after Tree of Life came out.
What happened?
There was this thing in the news about... for people who are listening that don't know the movie, it's... How long was it? 3 hours
long? Don't give it away because I'm about to watch it. I'm about to watch it, so don't give it away.
I'm not going to give anything away other than that this particular theater had so many complaints that they put up a sign saying, you know, if you're going to see this movie, then you have to know what you're getting yourself into, and we're not going to give you any refunds. And if you walk out partway through, then that's your tough luck.
Wow.
I'm curious how I know that you have been very, very sort of free with the Bandcamp model, so to speak. Of, you know, it's either you're going to make a minimal investment to have to buy the digital copies, or you can embed it, or you can. You know, you encourage people to share it with their friends. And I want to know, what do you feel like that has had a positive or negative effect on your bottom line, or if it hasn't had any effect at all?
I can't tell, to be honest with you. I mean, my fundamental belief has always been that if something is meaningful to somebody, it has an inherent value. You know,
they're probably going to share it anyway.
Right. So, you know, as far as my bottom line, it's like... excuse me. You know, I don't want every dollar from a listener that I can possibly get. You know, I just don't. You know, there's enough people in the world that care about what I'm doing that I'm doing fine, you know? But it also, I don't know, Jeff, that's a really tough question to answer.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a good or bad thing. I don't know. I do want people to hear it. And I want people, you know, I don't know. I have this really purist motivation that I believe that what I'm doing is honest and meaningful. And I believe there's, you know, just like I needed to hear, hey, that's no way to say goodbye. There may be somebody that needs to hear, hey, kid, or you know, or I still believe in you. Right. You know,
I'm sure that you, after the advances, probably never saw a dime from the A&M records or the one that came out.
East Autumn Grin.
Yeah, or you were on what was it, Blackbird for a minute?
No.
Through Atlantic?
No, I was on A&M and then Interscope and then a series of independent labels. And I rarely saw any money from whether it was a major or a indie. But, you know, I'm not complaining. I've done just fine.
But there's this idea that we're at the tail end of an era that was kind of an anomaly when artists could actually make a living making music. That what we're seeing right now is not so much the destructive effect of the internet or technology as it is sort of a corrective push back to the way art has always been. Like, you need a patron in order to survive.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that, again, I think if you create something that's meaningful to somebody, there's ways that they can show their appreciation, whether that's coming to a show or buying a download or buying a disc. Some people still like to hear music. Mm-hmm. Some people still like to hold music. There's any number of ways. I mean, I don't... Listen, I mean, what I'm doing with my life is my risk alone. I don't know. I mean, unless we were in business together in a label, and we have a vested, you know, gain together or a vested risk. I mean, I don't know. The whole patron thing and the Kickstarter.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
No, I don't have any interest in that stuff. I think it's, I don't know. Listen, I have friends that do it and I wish them all the luck and all the great stuff that can come, you know, from making music with those types of budgets. But my feeling is that it's on me to do that. I don't want to engage my audience to that extent.
It's a very interesting, like, I look at that system and it's I see many different interesting sides to it. One of which is we had a local band here in Cleveland that was running a Kickstarter campaign and, you know, asked the local independent record store to post something about the Kickstarter campaign on their website, and the record store said, you know, we really kind of have an issue with doing that because, like, you know, it's taking sales away from us, you know, so I see kind of that side of things. But what that kind of made me think of, just as far as the whole Kickstarter, pledge music, whatever you're using, you know, as the patron type of system, is that you are essentially guaranteeing that, you know, X number of people are going to buy your new record. So that's kind of an interesting part of the whole concept.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I don't know. I can't come up with a metaphor to... Excuse me. I can't come up with a metaphor to completely express myself on this, you know? The people that listen to my records do everything from, you know, some of them are unemployed, some of them are CEOs, some of them are professors, some of them are mechanics. I don't want $500 from any of those people, okay? I mean, my job is to create something beautiful that attracts people to it, you know? And if that's several thousand people across the world that pay a dollar for it, then I'm happy. But I don't know, man. The risk is mine to manage, you know, it's my adventure. I think you get that kind of money from somebody and I don't know, it just feels wrong to me. I wouldn't ask my parents for that money. Why would I ask some dude that happens to like my songs? I don't get it. I don't get it.
You're definitely not alone on that tip. Like, I talked to somebody else this year that had run a successful campaign, and I asked them how easy it was to come to terms with doing that, and they said that they had a really hard time with it. That, you know, they said, whatever you want to call it, at the end of the day, it's begging. So I can understand, you know, that you'd be uncomfortable with that.
Well, I mean, maybe that's, you know, I come from a very blue-collar, work-earnest family, you know. I still want to believe that if I create something beautiful, it will attract people to it, you know. Again, I don't want to call it begging. I have friends that do it. I don't agree with it. I wish them all the success in the world, but I just don't, I don't agree with it. I really don't, you know. As far as I can tell, I don't know quite what, you know. I guess there's a reward in helping your favorite artist or one of your favorites make music. I'm sure there is, you know. But some of my best recordings were done, you know, in a room with no air conditioning, with one mic and a four track, you know. I can understand, you know, I miss on some level doing the more collaborative records, but there's way for me to do that. There's ways for me to do that, you know. I believe one of the things I'm interested in more is more of a co-op, and it's something I'm talking about for my next record, is to, you know, go in, you know, give the studio a percentage of sales and give the musicians a percentage of sales, and we all go in together as creative people, and there's a shared reward for us doing that together. And a lot of times, I think when people go into something together where there's a shared risk and reward, there's better results. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. I just think that's short-sighted. I think that the whole Kickstarter, the whole Pledge Music thing is a very short-sighted. It's not going to solve the fundamental issue, just like I was saying about streaming music is not going to, you know, Spotify is not going to solve it. We need a cultural shift where people value the arts. And don't sit around on YouTube watching fart videos, you know? I mean, seriously, I mean, you know,
yes,
it's a humiliation, you know? You know, you can go and see a beautiful Leonard Cohen performance that has 3,000 views, and then you go to a fart compilation, it's like 23 fucking million people have sat and watched this. Listen, man, I think it's funny, too. You know, don't get me wrong. But, you know, you get my point.
I do, and I think on some level what you're talking about is kind of a helpless reaction to just the fact that, as you mentioned, we're not in a stream, we're being kind of sprayed with the fire hose.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing.
And I think that part of the reason that the younger audience has sort of commodified music is that its presence is so constant. It's unavoidable.
Yeah, absolutely. It's everywhere. I mean, they, you know, it is everywhere. I know, man. I know. I've been trying to think of like some new occupation, you know, like some new expression that's never been done before. Like, I don't know, like maybe recording, like, I don't know.
Well, you know, as long as there's been music, we've wanted it with us always. And now we can. And it's kind of had the opposite effect. It's kind of pushed us away.
Oh, it's like if you've kissed the same person for 15 years.
I don't know, man. I think it's more like if you could kiss anybody in the world at the snap of a finger.
That's a great point, Jeff. Touche. You got it. There you go.
We're like monkeys with remote controls because it's just my, like, you can't wrap your head around the sheer tyranny of choice when it comes to the amount of music that you can experience at any time. And so it makes it hard, particularly for an artist like you. Your work really sort of demands attention. You know, it isn't background music. It tells a story, and it asks you to invest the time to sit, you know, maybe even with headphones on and listen.
Well, Jeff, yeah. And you know, it's all about grabbing that attention because, you know that, like, you know, somebody like you and me and really lots and lots of people out there that are music fans, like, we get so many albums that, like, if it doesn't grab your attention on that first listen, you know, it might be a few weeks before you go back to that, if you go back to that. And it's very bizarre to me still, like, how you'll just kind of, like, lose albums on hard drives. Obviously, you never had the problem of losing an album that you had the physical copy of. Maybe you misplaced the CD or the vinyl record. That's different. You would come across, you'd be like, oh, yeah, you know, here's this, you know, record by whoever. It's been a week or two since I've listened to that. I'd love to listen to that again. We just didn't have, like, the volume of albums in our collection back then that we do now. So like, there's just so much more competition for that attention.
Well, and also we had to go to the store.
Yeah.
And I think just the act of hopping on your bike or getting in your car and going to the store helped you kind of build a relationship with that album before you even had it in your hand. And this is where I will present sort of a flip side. I'm not advocating Kickstarter at all, but I'll present the flip side to the argument, which is just yesterday I got the new album from David Mead, which was done through Kickstarter, and I donated to the campaign, I think, way back in, I don't know, January or something. So I paid for the album, you know, 9 months before I got it. And I had to wait for it. And I got all these updates from him. You know, then I didn't want to listen to it until I had it in my hand, so I didn't read any of them. But it was kind of a constant reminder that this record was coming. And so by the time it actually showed up in the mail, I felt like, I don't know, like in a weird way, I had earned the right to sit and spend time with it.
That's beautiful, Jeff. You know, I mean, it is. David's a friend of mine, and I, you know, I think it's beautiful. I think I have the record as well. It's a beautiful record.
Oh yeah, it's so good.
You know, different strokes for different folks, man. You know.
Well, yeah, and I'm just I wonder what that shift will be. I wonder what will happen to kind of reconnect us on that primal level with music. You know, I think most people really love music, but there's something, as you sort of alluded to, that there's something that has kind of shifted in our DNA in terms of how we relate, because it's just around all the time.
Well, I think we've got like a spiritual sweet tooth or something. You know? It's like, I want more cake. I want some cookies, some
and now
chips.
I feel sick.
I need something salty. You know? I don't know, man.
Well, hey, Matthew.
Yeah?
So musically, I just want to, you know, talk about, I just saw you're going to be taking a part in a tribute to the Replacements in New York in November.
Yeah.
How'd you get wrapped
That's
in
perfect.
With that?
I'm in that documentary, and I'm friends with the guy who shot it. And
Gorman?
Yeah. You guys know Gorman?
We interviewed him for the Popdos podcast a while back.
Yeah.
He still hasn't sent me a screener for that goddamn movie. I'd love to see it.
Gorman's a great guy. He is busy, though. So I wouldn't take. I try not to take it personal. And Jesse Mallon had reached out and asked if I wanted to be part of it, and absolutely. You know, I love the Replacements.
I'd like to hear you do "Here Comes a Regular."
I've done that one before. That's a great song. I mean, there's so many of them.
Of course.
You know. But you know, guys, I mean, we've been like the old guys at on Sesame Street, you know. I think the thing is that you know, the goal is for life to become more beautiful, you know. And that should be the goal, you know. History kind of dictates that should be the goal. I don't think that people look for like spiritual atrophy, chaos, you know. I think we're at an interesting point in our history, and I think we're really being confronted with our nature, and I think we're just going to have to define it going forward. It's what I recall Standing So Nothing Could Fall is about. It's about reclamation, and some of those things may be uncomfortable, but your ability to embrace what's beautiful about our current times, but also reconsider some of the things we're doing and where we're headed, because at the root we lose intimacy with ourselves and we lose intimacy with each other, and there's nothing more dangerous. The reason you can drop bombs from a plane is because you don't have to look people in the eye, and that's what could be happening socially the more we disengage with intimacy.
That's beautifully put. I don't know where we can go from there. That's pretty perfect. All I can say after that is please don't stop making records.
Oh, I will. We all do.
What else do you have coming up that you want people to know about?
Hammock and I, well, we have some touring coming up, and I'm taking out a small band, and it's beautiful. And
excellent.
And you'll, I think, realize how organic, people that come will realize how organic these songs are, which I'm excited about. I love that duality between the film and the play, you know, that relationship between the movie and the stage, you know, is beautiful. And then I also am finishing up a record with an ambient band called Hammock, and it's beautiful, and so that should be coming out shortly.
Very cool.
Yeah. And then
where are you going to go on the road?
You know yet? We're working on the dates right now. It looks like the Northeast, the Midwest, you know, Texas.
Me and Matt.
Yeah. Perfect. See. Matt, I'm actually going to be living near you in about a month. I'm moving up to I'm moving up to Northwest Pennsylvania. Which
no
I
kidding, nice.
Yeah, I can't wait, man. I can't wait. This summer down here enough.
You know somebody that's a fan that I don't know if you're aware that he's a fan, but Midwest Heartland rocker Michael Stanley is a fan of your music.
I did know that because his manager had sent me his version of Guilty, which I thought was great. I really loved it. You know? Yeah. He seems like a good, clearly excellent taste.
Yeah.
No, I know Michael Stanley's been around for a long time. I don't mean to make it sound all about, you know. No, he's a good guy, and I like quite a bit of what he's done.
No, it's cool because obviously being here in Cleveland, I have a bit more familiarity with, you know, what he's been up to in the past 20 years than, you know, some that are outside of Cleveland perhaps. But he's a songwriter at heart, and he's continued to stay engaged with, you know, guys like you that are making music. You know, a guy named Bill Deasy and his band, the Gathering Field, out of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of interesting to see guys like him that, you know, stay connected with other guys that are, you know, really doing the same thing that, you know, it's just nice to see somebody like that that's still interested in hearing music.
Listen, man, it speaks volumes about who he is. I mean, it is very hard when you have a horse in the race at times to continue to allow yourself to be engaged like that, because it can scare you. I mean, I can remember, I think it was Lennon talking about, who was it? You know, I think when he first started hearing about Bob Dylan, he said he felt threatened, you know? I mean, it's just part of our competitive nature, you know? We're all egotist.
Well, Jeff, I think that's a good wrapping point, sir.
I think so, too. Thank you.
No, Matthew, thank you, guys.
That wraps up our conversation with Matthew Ryan in this edition of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. Make sure you visit Matthew's website at MatthewRyanOnline.com and pick up that excellent new album, I Recall Standing As Though Nothing Could Fall. And please, go see him play a show. We'll be back very soon with another edition of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us.